Sometimes there's a podcast that, well, it's the podcast for its time and place. It's called Accept the Mystery, and this week Jackie and I are discussing the Coen's cult classic, The Big Lebowski, just as soon as I find a cash machine. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got us some family here.
This ain't no coon, huh?
Okay, I'm not gonna sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a lion!
You will find a fortune. It would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you're raised hell.
When I've raised hell, you'll know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is worse. Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast.
And we are back on Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast, the podcast where we discuss every single Coen Brothers movie in extreme, excruciating, exhausting, line-by-line, over-thought-out levels of detail. My name is Josh Richmond, and sitting across from me is my co-host, Jackie Lechtoldse, Tinder expert.
That's me.
Yep.
48-hour Tinder expert.
Yeah, you just started this, yeah, and already...
24 hours?
You've already mastered it and have like a million messages.
Yeah, guys, I just got on Tinder, so it's really funny.
Is Tinderous the right word?
Is Tinderous? A Tinderous?
Somebody, a woman who uses Tinder would be a Tinderous.
I think that's
or a
sexist.
Tinderer. Is that really sexist?
Yeah, it's like you don't want to be called like an actress anymore, you know? It's a thing.
Do you object to the word actress?
No, not at all. But okay. A lot of people do, so right, I'm just taking a stand.
Well, then don't call me sexist.
Some people would, though, and I just want to speak for them.
That's fair. I think that's fair.
Yep.
Yeah, no, we were sitting at UCB yesterday, and you were going through all your Tinder messages, and I was... And because I have no service on my cell reception...
Yeah, you couldn't swipe.
I couldn't swipe.
I was away.
So I was just looking at Tinder loading, and the little spinny loading screen kept going and going, and I was like, this is a metaphor for my love life.
Yeah, but then remember later when all four of us were watching the movie, and before we did, we were sitting around this table and four of us were just looking at our Tinder. So that says a lot about just like modern culture.
It probably does. That we don't want to make connections with each other. We're just desperately trying to make connections on our phones.
No, we already know each other. It was fine. We don't need to know each other.
We're like, okay, we're connected. We're good. We can absorb ourselves.
Well, listen, I just got on Tinder. It's like super exciting. So, you know, we'll see how that goes.
And you also introduced me to Jay Swipe. Which I did not even know.
That's right, J Swipe, Jewish Tinder people. Get on it. That's where your shirt is.
I didn't know that J Swipe was a thing until just this moment.
Well, look, if you want to get the Jewish ladies.
Oh, you can go on there and say willing to convert if you are.
What if you're not willing to convert? You're just into Jews.
There's no category for that.
There should be.
Ain't nobody cur if we're not willing to convert.
I went to a Jewish high school, and there were totally just like non-Jewish kids there who were like, look, I'm not Jewish. I feel like you guys get a good education here.
Yeah, but people on J-Swipe were like trying to marry within the tribe. You know what I'm saying? So
I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess.
Or at least trying to hook up casually within the tribe.
Right.
Right.
Which doesn't matter, though. That's why it's like...
Right. That's the thing. If you're Jewish, you don't care about hooking up with other Jews or not. It doesn't make a difference, I don't think.
No.
If you're trying to get married,
but
it makes a difference.
But it's kind of nice when you have like more in common, I guess. But like, I have so much in common with non-Jews. I don't know. Whatever. Enough about my love life, Josh.
All right.
We do this every freaking episode, which is fine.
This is
have a Tinder comment later. Wait, I'll just say it now. I got to reference my knowledge that I've gotten from this podcast talking to somebody on Tinder because he had like platinum blonde hair in one of his photos. I don't know. It seemed to be a costume. And I was like, oh, whoa, looking like Gare from Fargo. It was like the best line ever. He's a film student. He loved it. It was hilarious.
And
so,
I was like that.
This podcast gets me lots of dudes.
And I was like, that. I was like, I don't feel like that's a flattering thing to call somebody.
Oh, but he loved it. He thought it was really funny.
You're like the guy.
Because I said it, I was like, even though he's like a psychopath, like I don't mean it in a bad way. Because Gare's fucking awesome. Anyway.
Yeah, you're like the guy who put the guy in the wood shepherd in Fargo.
Yeah, no, sexy. I love him. But that's a different topic.
Also on today's show, the other voice you heard is...
Sorry, talk about me so long. Uh-huh.
Plays an improviser on teams such as Icky Pep. Also goes by Thomas the Intern from the Improv for Humans podcast. Please welcome Thomas... Wallet. Did I say it right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes! Wallet.
You said it right?
You're yes!
Pretty good.
Called it.
Wait, can you say it yourself?
Thomas Wallet.
Wallet. Okay.
I said Wallet.
Yeah. You were really close.
I was really close.
Welcome.
Welcome to the JFI Studios.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. I'm very, very excited to talk about this movie. But before we even get into the movie itself, we have to do our first segment of the show, which is called Inside Thomas Wallet.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
oh no! And what happens in this segment is we ask our guest questions loosely inspired by the movie of the week to try to get to know them a little bit better.
Awesome.
In the film The Big Lebowski, the dude's car gets stolen soon after he tosses the Ringer bag and spends most of the film trying to get it back. Has your car ever been stolen? And if not, what is the longest you've spent looking for your car in a parking lot wondering if it was stolen?
Oh my God.
Thankfully my car has never been stolen.
That is good.
The longest I ever spent looking for my car in a parking lot was when I looked for my car in a parking lot that it wasn't parked in.
Oh, nice.
Because I don't know if you guys have ever been there on the 3rd Street Promenade.
I knew you were going to say that one. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because they all look the same.
Right. There's like 3 or 4 different parking structures that all have like... It's crazy. They have like the same interior. They must be owned by like the same company or something.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah, they do have a couple scattered around that all look exactly the same.
So it was like the biggest mind fuck ever. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can swear on this.
Yes, you can.
Okay, great. It was the biggest mind fuck ever.
How are we going to talk about the Big Lebowski without saying fuck at some point?
Just bleep it all out.
I knew exactly where I was parked, and I went to that spot in this like twin universe parking structure, but my car wasn't there. It was weird.
That's happened to a group of my friends too. Like, I knew it was the wrong structure, and I don't remember if I said it initially or they, like, I held it to myself just to see what would happen. But there was definitely like time wasted in the wrong structure, and I was like, "Yeah, right. It's the other one." Like, I knew it was the other one, but yeah, they're exactly the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have a few memories actually that go with this. One was being in the Disneyland parking lot for like an hour with my dad, trying to find
a big parking lot.
It's a very big parking lot. And my dad was just getting very, very, very frustrated. And eventually we just gave up. And we got, I think, driven around by like security and we found the car. Wow. But we were kids and we were like, we're never going to get out of here. It's really late.
Has your car, have either of your guys' car been stolen before?
No.
My car has never been stolen. But but my worst story involving this, and I may have told this story elsewhere before, is when I went to two or three years ago when I went to... Coachella Festival, just for a day.
Call it Coachella Festival. Coachella Music.
Sorry. Yes, the Coachella Music and Arts Festival.
That one. Yeah, okay,
that one.
Understood.
So you can distinguish it from Stagecoach or some other festival.
I've got a picture of it. I can imagine it.
Good.
I'm there.
Good scene work.
Okay.
Radiohead's my favorite band. They were headlining. I just wanted to go down for that Saturday and watch them. I went down, I was in like a huge hurry because I was running late, and there were a few bands I wanted to see, so I parked my car, and then I ran into the festival. I didn't really think about where I parked. I was there, I watched the concert, and then I decided actually, a little bit before Radiohead said it, you know what, I'm going to go look for my car. It's got to be around here somewhere. But nobody had left yet, so the parking lot was full, and I spent a long time walking through the parking lot, couldn't find it. Spent maybe an hour wandering around, couldn't find it. Then I decided, you know, I'll wait for everybody else to leave. I waited for everybody to leave the grounds. Still couldn't find it.
What?
Looking through like almost completely empty parking lot. I feel like I've explored every inch of it. My car is still not there. I'm like, somebody stole my car. My car has been joyrided or somebody or some was it one got high and stole it, something like that. Eventually, I talked to I asked the security guard, what should I do? And he said, I don't know, but you got to get out of here. So I walked down the road till I found a motel.
Oh, my God.
I crashed there, and then I woke up at 5 a.m. before the next day started. I'm like, I really actually have to get back to Los Angeles. but I finally found somebody who was willing to drive me through the parking lot, and they couldn't find it. I got my dad to come pick me up, and we filed a police report with the NDOPD. And then I went back to L.A., and started, you know, shopping for a new car.
What?
And then 5 days later, I got a call from the NDOPD saying, hi, you're Josh Richmond, right? We found your car. It was in the Coachella parking lot.
Right.
The whole time.
Oh, my God.
Because what are the odds of you losing your car? Like, you doing something, like, you just being thoughtless and not remembering where your car was parked, and then it also getting stolen. Like that same instance.
Exactly.
You know?
Like,
but what if it is what happened and somebody brought it back? But that would be weird.
And that was my working theory for a while. You know what? Maybe somebody really needed a car, stole it, then the next day felt guilty about it and brought it back to the same spot.
You really don't want to accept that you just couldn't find your car in the parking lot.
You guys looked for it.
It seems impossible because I looked so hard for it.
And other people looked for it.
And then it got like authority figures to look for it and they also could find it. So it's not just me who's crazy.
You know what? I'm with you, Josh, because that's exactly what I would think too. I love your working theory. Thomas, I know you're injecting some statistical analysis into this, which I appreciate.
Thank you.
Which is smart, but I'm going to go with the off chance that it was stolen.
And I don't appreciate your sarcasm.
That this is
it was not sarcasm.
We're actually we're reenacting a scene in Big Lebowski where Lebowski's car gets stolen. Walter is like, what does he say? Oh, it could have got towed because you were parked in the handicap parking spot.
Right. It could have.
Like, there was a chance that it could have
been. You know what? There is a chance. I don't know if they ever tow people for being in a handicap parking spot.
They do.
They do, for sure.
$250 fine. And your car can get towed.
There you go.
I happen to know that from
I thought. I thought maybe it was just a parking ticket, but apparently you can get towed as well.
No, you can get towed, yeah, for sure.
Jackie drives a tow truck
No, but she is a lawyer.
I actually had a weird assignment where I had to like go to one of our clients. I think it was just kind of liable, like for employment stuff. We had to like go and like measure parking spaces and make sure there's a sign that says that there's a $250 fine and you can get towed and all that. So... It was a random thing.
Cool. Case dismissed.
That's right. And the soundboard is back.
It did go anywhere.
I know, but the first time we heard it was the last episode that just came out.
That's true. That is true.
It's annoying because it's going to sound like my exact voice. Whatever. Anyway,
what's going to sound like your exact voice?
I'm not falling for it.
That's great.
So the dude's signature drink in this film is the White Russian.
Yeah, I'm a White Russian.
You are a White Russian. So as I mentioned yesterday, it's like you're drinking yourself when you drink
Yeah, that's right.
Do you have a signature drink? Or a drink that you tend to order more than any other?
I love coffee. And I drink coffee. I don't discriminate... to what time of day it is when I drink coffee. I'll drink it at late at night. I'll drink it at length, late at night.
Do you find that it hurts your sleeping patterns?
No. Actually, I just watched Coffee and Cigarettes. Have you guys seen that movie?
I have seen Coffee and Cigarettes.
I have not.
Yeah, and there's this thing that there's all these weird... It's like the movie's like a series of vignettes of people drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes.
Right.
But there's all these things that come back in like multiple vignettes, and one of the things is that if you drink coffee you'll dream faster.
They keep
saying that. Yeah, they're like, a lot of people say I like to drink coffee so I can dream faster, and that sounds like something Jim Jarmusch would say
that I don't think is actually true.
Oh, it's terrifying.
It sums up late night coffee drinking for me though.
You have dreams like that, like fast dreams?
You have hyperactive dreams?
I feel like I do. Or like when you drink coffee late at night and you're tired, you kind of feel like you're drinking or you're dreaming like really fast.
I feel like it is a thing. Oh God, that terrifies me.
Oh, you know what? I do know what that feeling is like when I have had caffeine late at night, because that will keep me up and I can't sleep. But you are when you're laying in bed and you've just been laying in bed not sleeping for over an hour.
Right.
It is almost like you're in that half sleep, half awake state where your thoughts do kind of merge with the dream mode, and it's a little bit in between.
Right. Oh God, I'm not a coffee drinker, and thank God, because I probably dream like 5 nights out of the week, and they're always like very intense dreams.
That's a lot of dreaming.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
I remember 5 nights out of the week usually. Wow. And if I drank coffee, that would just be terrifying. So.
They also say marijuana is a dream suppressant, which may explain why I dream less.
Yeah. I don't smoke, so that would also explain, why I don't
I've never had a dream. 420 every day.
That sounds so sad. I've never had a dream. It's kind of appropriate.
Can I just say that my signature drink is a Moscow Mule, which is related to a White Russian, although it doesn't taste similar.
A Moscow Mule?
Mule.
Moscow Mule.
Yeah.
Okay, I was like, this is what they
a
eat
Moscow
in...
A Moscow Mule! Yeah.
This is what they eat
there's
in Moscow.
Potatoes, there's right. onions in it.
Mmm.
Vodka, yeah, no, Moscow Mules.
Wait, what is a Moscow? What is a
it has
Moscow
like
Mule?
Ginger beer and like lime juice and vodka. Sometimes there's syrupy stuff too, but they're delicious.
That sounds nothing like a White Russian, but
not at all.
Good.
But it has a Russian, you know, Moscow Mule. I should drink White Russian just to make a point. And the ones you made last night were amazing.
I made really good White
Russians.
They
were amazing.
I seriously
like
did.
They were so good. Yeah, that was crazy.
You missed out. They were some high quality, top notch. I mixed them like a scientist.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
excellent.
But typically, my drink of choice would just be a vodka tonic.
Yeah, and I drink those a lot too.
I do drink those
very
a lot.
Refreshing.
Because they're simple and refreshing.
Yeah.
And I'm a man of simple taste.
They're hydrating too.
And yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yum.
Mm-hmm.
So the dude's game of choice, meanwhile, is bowling. Although I'm not sure if we ever actually see him throw a ball in this film. I feel like he's always just sitting at the bowling alley.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good point.
That's weird, a right? big one.
You usually see Donnie throwing balls. Right. Yeah, and Donnie. He's just kind of sitting there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
He does embody a bowling ball in one of the dream sequences.
That is true. At a certain point, he seems to... and also, he gets like absorbed by a bowling ball and kind of
yes.
like...
is in it.
Is inside
subsumed.
Of it. Subsumed. Subsumed by the bowling ball. I believe you are a regular game player. What are your games of choice?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Chess, I love.
Oh, so you're
chess
a player.
Is not a game. It's a sport. But continue.
It's the sport of kings, Jack.
Okay. Why do you say that?
Oh, I'm just being obnoxious. So no. My dad always says he's a chess player.
I'm with you. Look, Russians have a great lineage of chess grandmas.
I'm okay with chess being a game, though. I think there is... okay. I think games are just as valid as sports. You know? And... Yeah, to me, it doesn't have an athletic component, I guess.
Mental athletic.
I guess.
We could talk about games versus sports. That's a whole podcast.
Unless it's like how hard you're going to upend the chessboard when you're losing. Right, there's an athletic element to that.
In my case, is really hard.
I'm not amazing chess player by any means, but I was briefly an after-school chess instructor to like a third and fourth graders.
Oh, cool. I do that job. That is my job?
Oh, yep. Really? Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Oh,
wait. Maybe I don't want to say who I work for, but we can talk about it after.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys should teach me
because despite the fact that my dad is such a good chess player, also I've been taught chess so many times and I literally always forget it.
We will.
I'm not bad at it when I play it, but I'm like, if you ask me the rules right now, I'd be like, I don't know, pawn's gonna go forward.
There's a lot of little rules that are easy to forget.
Yeah, like, but I forget the big rules too.
On passant, things like that.
So this is funny because last night I actually played a little chess and I played with my roommate, Zach, and I'm like, how much have you played? Because we always talked about playing because I teach chess and he was like, you should, help me get better or whatever. Right. And he's like, I've probably played 5 games in my life and I learned the rules when I was like 10. And we played one game last night and he was... really, really good at chess to the point where I got really excited and kind of freaked him out where I was like, we have to keep playing. I want to know what the ceiling is on your potential.
It's like, you have untapped talent.
Yes.
I'm going to be your mentor. Yeah.
And that's kind of the type of guy he is. He's just like really talented at random stuff. Like we went golfing and he was so good at golf. And this is like a new project for me is that I'm going to teach him chess and like see how good I can
get. Some people I think just have that kind of like natural spatial visual aptitude. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I can visualize what's going to happen a few moves down the line.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, I love chess as well. You can see I've got just a giant collection of board games behind
me. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And as opposed to books and other things. And yeah.
What is anti-monopoly?
That, I'll be honest, is a game I've never played. I got that as a gift, but I did look at the rules, and it's kind of like Monopoly, but a socialist version.
I was just going to say, it has to be either socialist or anarchist.
It's like we're like, you win if everybody has close to the same amount of money.
To describe your shelf, you've got a big shelf with a bunch of movies and stuff, and on the top shelf are probably like... 24 board games.
Yes.
And you've got Monopoly.
And anti-Monopoly.
And right beneath it is anti-Monopoly,
I like that.
Which is like opposite colors. It's a black box.
Yep.
Kind of looks like Soviet Russia, where my family came from.
Yep. Uh-huh. Monochromatic instead. Uh-huh. I don't really need that. I don't know. Jackie, are you a game player at all, really?
I am not really.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. I don't...
Tinder's a game.
It's a game. It tells you to keep playing, which is so weird. Thank you for helping me find a game
And you're an instant master at that.
That's right. I just have natural skills.
You have natural Tinder skills.
So good at it, guys.
It's more of a sport.
It's like a mental sport. No, I think I play, if I play games, I enjoy them. Like, I'm looking at Clue. That's a fun game. There's some games that I like, but I'm just not a natural, like, board gamer. Like, when we played Cards Against Humanity, that was fun. Mm-hmm. Like, when we did that a while
ago. That is a fun game, and that's, like, an easy game to learn. It's a fun party game.
Yeah, and then there's, like, isn't there, like, an apples-to-apples kind of game?
Cards Against Humanity is like the, you know, the perverted version of apples. No, I know, but there's all,
yeah. Is the what?
It's like perverted apples.
Oh,
apples,
well, so okay. So
it's, the anti,
it's the anti apples to apples. And I have both of those next to each other as well. I like funny. Collecting games and anti games.
What's
just
funny though is like, so I have a group of like my gay friends, both male and female, love board games. Like all my gay friends love board games and they have so much fun. So sometimes when I'm in this, like, you know, in this scene with them, we end up playing board games. I'm like, oh, this is like funner than I thought, but I would never imagine to like play board games. It's like not a thing, but when I do it, I like it.
Your friends have good taste.
Yeah, I know. Awesome. That's why they're my friends.
Yeah. So Maud Lebowski in this film is some kind of bizarre hybrid painter / performance artist.
Right.
What is your opinion of modern or abstract art? Of the, like, I'm going to film myself sitting in a box for 30 days and call it art variety.
I think that this is going to sound really pretentious, but sure. I feel like the value of art is like the amount that it can make people think.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of art, even though like maybe the skill level required to make it is lower,
right?
Like the actual like coordination or whatever is lower, mm-hmm. it's probably just as provocative, if not more provocative of thought.
Or it could still be, interesting.
A lot of...
I could see what they're going for there.
Right.
Right.
So I like it. I feel like I go, I said mindfuck already, and maybe I'll say it a bunch of times because we're talking about Big Lebowski, but I don't know much about art. So when I go to an art museum like LACMA or something, I just try to kind of wrap my head around everything I see. And I know that I don't have any like historical lens or like any kind of like knowledge based understanding of what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
So then I just try to be affected by it, and that's a really nice way to enjoy art, especially
I do
art like that, you know?
Interesting.
I mean, I try to have like an inclusive definition of art, and mm-hmm. think like it's the second you define what art is and what isn't, that's when you find something that, you know,
right.
breaks that rule. I do sometimes feel like certain projects are like art school students thinking, okay, what's the easiest path I can take
right.
to creating art,
right?
And like maybe, like just thinking, you know, maybe I don't have painting talent or sculpting talent, so I am just going to do something crazy and conceptual because it's what I can do.
Yeah, I think you can tell. I think you can spot that a mile away.
I'm a little bit snobby about art too, but in a different way, I think, because I kind of like art that's more like aesthetically pleasing. So to me, it's not necessarily about how much it's making you think, but how right. much it's affecting you, like in a visual sense, and like how it affects mm-hmm. you in that way. And I think, like, I don't love a lot of either modern or contemporary art for like how beautiful I think it is necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think when I'm looking at art, like I really appreciate if I know it was like really hard to do and it looks really
right.
beautiful
yeah.
or extensive or
there,
skilled or something like
that's
that.
That's the thing. As much as I love a lot of modern art, you do go back and you look like, I don't know, like a Renoir or something and think, wow, look at the technique and the years.
That just like affects me a lot
yeah.
more when I look at it. But also I think there's like a little bit of a distinction between like art and design too. Even though design is part of art, I guess the way to me when I think of like what's really like artful is something that's like very skilled and difficult to make. And then when I see something like that, it affects me. And then other stuff is like, oh, that's great design, but I don't think of it as much of like as art, even though it's aesthetically pleasing. I mean, mm-hmm. it's art, but I'm just saying to me there's sort of like a gradient or something.
Do you have
too.
A favorite work of art, Jackie?
I don't think I have a favorite work itself. I really like classical fine art, but I could also just be biased because that's also like what I like to do. So like I do oil painting and stuff, and that to me is just like the most enjoyable and I just am drawn towards. But I mean, I like a lot of other art too, but I'm definitely a little bit more particular to stuff that was like difficult to make. So
yeah, and I guess I'm somewhere in the middle because I do love stuff like Rothko or Mondrian or some of
yeah.
this, that very, very abstracted art
yeah.
that probably wasn't all that difficult to paint, but does look really cool and is the kind of thing I would love to have hanging on my wall.
Right. Yeah.
Or I do have this Murrow print right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I was looking at that as we were talking about. But
this whole question was an extended way of getting us to compliment.
We love the art in your place,
Josh.
Yeah,
great taste,
thank you.
Josh.
Thank you. Finally, the Tonight Podcast was finally say something.
Before I admitted that it's more than just design.
Yeah, this is a painting. This is like a long kind of, it's a foot wide and maybe
yep.
3 foot
tall.
Yeah, and just kind of a long Baroque print. It's just primary colors and some curvy lines and a little star on top.
Yeah, it's
green's
nice.
Not a primary color, but we'll allow it.
Case closed.
Thank you.
It's a primary color if you think like the RGB scale, like if you're mixing colors of light.
Ooh, right? On RGB?
Yeah.
But then, isn't it just...
Siri, what are the primary colors?
Thank you. Damn, this is why Thomas is an intern, because he's like on top of this.
Because like there's print colors in CMYK, but like if you look at the pixels on a TV, or at least like on an old CRT TV, it's RGB colors.
Okay, but you said primary colors, not RGB colors, dude.
Okay, we're all taking out our phones this
year. Yeah, we need to know. Fastest.
I'm actually just on Tinder right now.
Yeah, I got a message in the meantime, but I'm being polite and not looking at it.
Thank you.
That's right. I have respect for this podcast.
Primary color. The first definition of any of a group of colors from which all other colors can be obtained by mixing.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is what I thought as well. RGB doesn't have yellow. It's red, green, and blue.
That's what I was saying. Mm-hmm. But said green is not a primary color.
That's RGB, though. Primary colors are yellow, red, and blue. Oops. Primary color.
See, if sometimes primary colors are yellow, red, and blue, and sometimes it's red, green, and blue.
It's not sometimes.
This has red,
name.
Green, yellow, and blue, so I'm going to say that's primary colors.
Oh, you're saying primary colors is a general category.
As a general category,
RGB is a.
You know what I mean? There's no like fuchsia or burnt orange in there. It's just big bold colors. Anyways, this is a semantic.
I think
argument.
Red. Okay, sorry. Red, yellow, blue is like a visual art, or it's like a painting thing. That's why that's what I thought it was. But RGB is not yellow.
I think they're both definitions of primary colors. That's what I'm saying.
I'll allow it.
Thank you.
That was me and not the soundboard.
I'll allow it. I'll allow it. I'll allow it.
All right.
Don't get too excited.
It is time to dive into the movie of the week, and this segment is called The Big Review Scheme.
Finally!
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
So, the film Big Lebowski, starring Jeff Bridges and John Goodman, almost certainly the Coen brothers' most popular movie and biggest cult classic. Not the first Coen brothers movie I saw, but definitely I think the first Coen brothers movie I was like introduced to freshman year of college. Like, you've got to see this film. This is a classic, and I think any discussion of this movie really has to start with the central character, who's kind of taken on a life of its own even outside of this film. Mm-hmm. Which is Jeff Bridges' performance as Jeffrey Lebowski, a.k.a. the dude, the little Lebowski.
He's not the big Lebowski.
He is not the big Lebowski, makes him the little Lebowski.
Well, and then at the end, spoiler alert, there is a baby Lebowski.
Yeah.
So he's kind of like there the
might
middle
be,
Lebowski.
Right, there might be an even littler Lebowski on the right. way.
The littlest Lebowski.
It's like a
it's Christmas story.
It is. The littlest Lebowski. But it's just... It's also one of those performances that's become so associated with Jeff Bridges in particular.
Right.
It's become his like signature character to the point that most of his performances since then have been him playing variations on the dude.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at the time he had read the Coen Brothers description, he was like, Who is this person? I don't understand why this guy is like the protagonist of this crime story.
Right.
The Coen Brothers have gone on record saying that this really is essentially a detective story. Mm-hmm. This is a takeoff on Raymond Chandler.
Right.
Hard-boiled detective stories, right. The Philip Marlowe stories.
Right.
Except instead of having a typical hard-boiled detective type, having this just very laid-back, hippie burnout, passive stoner type falling into one situation after another and trying to hold all the pieces together.
Right.
In his head, lots of ins, lots of outs, lots of what have yous, keeping it all together.
Yeah, it's a movie about a guy trying to get his rug back.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it really ties together the room.
And some guy peed on his fucking rug.
Right.
This whole podcast could just be us saying lines. I'm gonna try as much as possible not to just quote this movie repeatedly. Because it is almost certainly the Coen Brothers' most quotable film.
I was just writing down so many quotes.
Yeah. So,
Nothing is Fucked is my favorite one, because it's also something my coworker says all the time, and it really applies to legal work.
Nothing is fucked.
Yeah.
Are you surprised at my tears, sir, is my favorite line in the movie.
Strong men also cry. As long as we're talking about dialogue, I do have a statistic about this. The word dude is said 161 times in this film.
Nice.
Sounds fair. I think the word
fuck, how many times?
Yeah, the key word of this film is fuck. The word fuck is said 292 times.
It really doesn't feel... It's so natural how they say it.
I didn't even notice that
excessive, but if you start noticing it, they do say fuck a lot.
A lot.
It's so weird.
It's punctuating every single sentence.
I did not hear it. I literally only remember them saying nothing is fucked. Other than that, I don't remember it.
No, that's like twice a minute almost.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay, wait. If it's about a 2-hour film, so about 120 minutes, yeah. So more than twice a minute.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I know.
I'm so impressed right now.
But it does feel natural because it's just the way these guys kind of punctuate their sentences.
Mm-hmm.
This is a famous clip that you've possibly heard the censored version of the "this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass" scene.
Oh, great!
In case you were wondering what happens when they try to play this movie on like Comedy Central and how they deal with it, or I could play this.
What are you doing, man?
Walter's about to smash his sports car.
Thank you for the context, podcast veteran.
Here you go, Larry. You see what happens? You see what happens, Larry? See what happens? This is what happens, Larry. You see what happens, Larry? You see what happens when you find a stranger in the Alps?
In the Alps?
Do you see what happens when you fight a stranger in the Alps?
Oh my god.
You see what happens, Larry? This is what happens when you feed a scrambled eggs. What happens, Larry?
When you feed someone scrambled eggs?
What the hell are you doing?
You get the idea.
When you fight a stranger in the Alps.
That's so weird.
This is what happens when you fight a stranger in the Alps. I can't imagine what the rest of that movie is like. This seems like a movie that would be impossible to show on network or basic cable TV.
A lot of ADR, right? Is that the right word? Is that the right term?
That is the right word.
Boom.
Yes, that is the right word.
I can't really watch TV movies because I have like this weird completist anxiety.
Oh
that
my god!
Even if
me
they're showing
too.
It, even if they're showing it like uncensored, that sometimes they cut a scene or two for time.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm that just
right,
makes
it takes
me so anxious.
Right.
Agree.
Yeah. You're like, maybe I'm missing a detail about the character that I should have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
No, it is infuriating.
I hate that. Yeah.
But yeah, okay, so the central character of the dude, who is such an unlikely protagonist for this kind of movie, but is so memorably embodied by Jeff Bridges.
Right.
Who plays it, because he plays it so naturally.
Right. Yeah, he did a good job.
I think the critic Pauline Kael said about Jeff Bridges once that Jeff Bridges was the most natural on-camera actor she'd ever seen.
Yes.
And he does have just kind of an ease on camera. You know, the Coens have very stylized dialogue. And
right.
And a lot of actors, sometimes they seem like they're caricatures by trying to say this very stylized kind of rat-a-tat,
right,
broad dialogue. But the dude never feels like that.
That's very true, yeah.
I think his greatest scene in this movie, just from an acting perspective, is when he gets pulled into the limo of the Big Lebowski.
I was just about to say that. That's a brilliant scene.
And he's kind of just trying to defend what's been happening the past 2 days, which is basically that this whole scheme has gone horribly awry. And he doesn't really say anything at all. He's just like, well, whatever, you know, like, if you look at it, and he just kind of, like, stutters like that, and it's just
He feels like he's got to defend himself, but he's just babbling and trying to get anything that
because he never really, like, he's such a weird, and I see why he's become, like, this Zen Buddhist kind of icon thing, too, because he never really, for a protagonist, he never really takes action, he never really changes. His whole, like, want as a character is to return to the status quo. Like, his whole motivation to even leave his apartment is to get
the
rug back.
He's got to get the rug back, yeah.
And so, to be pulling towards the middle so hard is, like, all he can ever do, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Can I just make a comment about that, too, though, like, right away? Is that he took the rug without permission first. So he's not...
not his original rug.
No, but, like, then... That's not the rug that was stolen. That was the rug that was peed on.
Yeah, but
then
he
got
okay.
the new rug.
But
from
he had to get
the
he had to get. But he had to get the rug replaced.
Right.
Right. But the way he got the rug replaced was just by walking out and being like, "The old man said I could have it."
Right.
Are you saying that's karma? That's karma catching up with him?
No, I'm not even saying it's karma. I'm just saying that he did do something that was not so zen, which is just lie and be like, "Yeah, he said I could take it," which I thought was brilliant.
I guess
like,
that's
who's going to question him? He's like, "Yeah, he said I could have it." It was so smooth too, but because he was so zen about it, nobody called him out.
The interesting thing is that The Big Lebowski is actually, you find out very late in the movie that he is not a good guy and he's not who he's saying he is.
I mean, so, he never seems like a good guy, but you find out that, yeah, he's been lying about his fortune and his Hulk scheme and everything.
So, like, arguably, I think that the dude, like, that's not even immoral because he's, like, taking the rug back from someone who's actually scamming him. So even that, like, fits into this weird Zen thing.
I mean, if you're really getting into the politics of this film, there are multiple times when somebody is yelling at the dude, whether it is the Big Lebowski or whether it's the chief of police of Malibu, like, you bums are the problem with society. Why don't you guys just get a job and stop being such a deadbeat?
And he is an aging hippie. He does say that he signed the original... what is it? The Port Huron statement, which is like this old hippie.
Yeah, no, that
SDS
he was
thing.
That he was part of the Seattle Seven, which was like this anti-war group, and the character of the dude was based on a real person named Jeff Dowd, who was a friend of the Coen brothers, who was part of the Seattle Liberation Front. Was this real kind of burnout character, though not as actually laid back as the dude is, but. Yeah, there are real roots there, and there are real politics there, and you're right that the dude is almost never actually active and is almost always trying to return to the status quo, which does make the moments that he does take action, like, stand out as something that's, like, really funny and out of character, like the moment that Jackie Treehorn leaves the room after scribbling something down on a piece of paper. And suddenly he has one of his few moments of, like, okay, I'm going into sleuth mode. I'm going to figure out what he just wrote. And then he shades the paper, and it's just a guy with a big dick.
I love that that's what he drew, too. I have a telephone call. I got to make this note real quick.
which almost goes to say... In the universe of this movie, if you do try to take action like that, you're just going to find absurdity.
Yeah, and that leads to the second dream sequence and the really famous dream sequence, and which kind of gets the movie into the third act.
Yeah, as probably as close as the Coens will ever come to just a straight up music video. Is that second dream sequence, and it is. It is beautiful and. Part of the reason this movie, I think, has become such a favorite is just because the visuals and just the level of surrealism and some of these images are so over the top and so much fun. And that sequence was just a ton of fun to watch.
Totally. I did notice a really fun thing of the first dream sequence, I think, is actually the division of the first and second act. And that happens when he's lying on his carpet listening to his Walkman.
Yeah, but he gets knocked out.
And he gets knocked out. But he's listening to a tape, and you can actually see, if you pause the movie, you can see what's on the tape. And on the A side, the tape is Venice Beach League Players, 1987.
Yeah. So he's listening to tapes of people playing bowling.
Right, himself, I think.
Yeah.
And then the second side just says Bob, which is Bob Dylan. And then when he gets knocked out, Bob Dylan plays with like bowling imagery. So it's like he's dreaming what's on this tape.
That's right. That's cool. It's what's going through his head. And it is, and both really both dream sequences are just mishmashes of everything that he's seen throughout the movie so far. And that goes and that figures into his dialogue as well. You mentioned the scene where he gets dragged into the limo, and the best part of that scene is the babble that he is kind of spouting out, trying to make sense. It's just all these phrases that somebody else has said before him prior to the movie, like, you know, young trophy wife in the parlance of our times. Just like he has a habit throughout the film of somebody says something in his presence and it kind of sticks to him and he spits it back out. One of the first things you see is George W. Bush saying this aggression against Iraq will not stand.
George Bush.
Sorry, just normal George Bush.
Regular Bush.
Regular Bush. Bush classic.
Bush classic.
And then later he says, this aggression will not stand, man.
Yeah.
There's sometimes different characters that never encounter each other will repeat the same line. The guys who smash all the stuff in his apartment say, you see what happens? You see what happens? And then later Walter says, you see what happens? Right. Larry, you see what happens?
Right.
It's probably... the Coen brothers at the peak of just their them writing this kind of repetitive circular dialogue that they like to use in a lot of their films, but it's really, really apparent.
And I think that's what gives the movie its really like philosophical tone is that it starts to feel like a meditation after a while.
Yeah, very much so. Feeling like, you know, all these things have happened before and all these things will happen again. Just kind of all these motifs keep recurring and everything is tied into each other.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 130,000 people supposedly who are priests of the Church of Dudism, which is, you know, just kind of an unofficial movement of people trying to live by the dude's philosophy.
Right.
But if you go to their website and hear them break it down, they basically say it's essentially Taoism.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And if you don't know about Taoism, it's, you know, ancient Eastern philosophy that very much centers on, well, being centered.
Right.
And going with the flow and taking right. life's ups and downs and obstacles just as they come and kind of letting it wash
right.
over you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of brings me to, like, this idea of Walter being, like, the chaotic side of life
yeah.
and, like, uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I feel like Walter is equally a protagonist in this movie because he's the one who actually takes action and grows in the movie and learns stuff. And the dude is always this kind of like anti-protagonist who refuses to change and just absorbs what's happening.
Well, wait, do you think Walter really does learn more than the dude throughout the movie? What does Walter learn? How does he grow?
Okay. So what you learn about Walter is that he is like this angry, mm-hmm. angry person.
One of the best ways I saw it described online doing some research is that while the dude tries to just let everything pass over him, Walter can't let anything go.
Right.
He sees anything go wrong and he thinks he's in the right even a little bit.
Right.
And he's like, am I wrong? And
right.
goes nuts. I think that the whole over the line scene where he holds the gun at Smokey is just an amazing character moment.
And like, that's really early on.
It's really yeah. early on, and for the whole rest of the film you're like, okay, I know right. who this guy is. This is the guy with this just crazy
right.
trigger figure.
But the flip side of his rage is this other characterization, which is like, I think that the simple way they characterize Walter is like one of the best characters ever.
Mm-hmm.
Because you learn the first thing you learn is that he brings his ex-wife's dog to
right.
the bowling alley because he's taking
yeah.
care of the dog.
Yeah.
And then because she's on vacation with her new boyfriend in
yeah.
Hawaii.
Yeah.
And then the second thing you learn about that whole thing is that he observes Shabbat.
Yeah.
And that's because his ex-wife is Jewish.
I right. loved that part.
And show her fucking Shabbat.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's like some of the, that's so sad and like real. And
I really liked that part.
I guess I feel like the kind of capstone scene is when they scatter Donnie's ashes and
okay, yeah.
Walter gives a speech that he kind of twists around to make about Vietnam mm-hmm. instead of himself.
Yeah, which he also does throughout the film is turning
right.
everything into a
right.
About Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah.
But I would say the moment of personal growth that getting to that is right after that when he throws the ashes into the dude's face
yeah.
by accident. And then he just kind of apologizes and embraces the
right,
dude.
Right.
And I think that moment is like the defining moment of the movie is these two guys embracing and just like becoming whole.
I do agree with you. I don't know if it's necessarily like a huge moment of personal growth for Walter as
right.
much as kind of just a single moment of humanity for this guy
right.
where you're like, he's not a monster. These two people actually do care about each
right.
other.
Yeah, because there was some trouble understanding what the relationship was like up until that point.
Like why are these people friends with
yeah,
each other?
Yeah, it's like way too yin
right.
and yang. Why
well,
would the
it's
dude
totally,
have Walter around?
It's totally yin and yang. Like in that scene, if you watch it, the dude is like dressed all in like earth tones and like light colors.
Yeah.
And Walter is wearing a black shirt.
Yeah.
And even when he scatters the ashes, he makes the dude even like
a little
whiter.
Bit whiter, right?
And then when they embrace, it's
yeah.
like literally light and dark, like combining in
yeah.
that moment. Which
but
is
no,
totally.
Probably the key line of the film is Walter saying, "Ah, fuck it, dude, let's go bowling."
Right.
You know, like Donnie
yeah.
died. All this terrible shit has happened. The
right.
dude's house got wrecked. His car got wrecked.
Right.
All these. It's just basically a never-ending stream of bad things that happened
right.
to him throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, it's just kind of strikes and gutters, ups and downs, and you learn to live with it.
Right.
There is a powerful message to it. As much as the dude is supposed to be this super relaxed, super zen character, he actually spends most of the movie being, you know, kind of stressed out and upset and agitated.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus,
mm-hmm.
they're going to kill this poor woman. All this responsibility is suddenly on my shoulders. This
right.
isn't a guy who has to deal with a lot of responsibility.
As soon as he
yeah.
is relaxing in the tub with a J, you've got
yeah.
a nihilist banging down his door and throwing a ferret in the tub with
yeah,
him.
Exactly. Every time he has a single moment to relax. everything just falls apart for him again.
Yeah.
This is a guy who has had to really cultivate his Zen attitude.
Right.
And you see it with listening to tapes of him bowling, mm-hmm. or smoking J's, or right. pounding white Russians, right. or he's constantly regulating himself just right. to be able to kind of stay in that Zen mm-hmm. mode.
Isn't that very Zen?
That's the thing. It doesn't seem very Zen.
It's a lot of work to be Zen, I guess.
I think,
but that's not like personal work. That's like using a lot of substances to help him be Zen.
Right.
I'm a purist on that kind yeah. of thing, so I'm just saying it's not that Zen.
I mean, 420 every
well,
day.
That, I think, yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of the. I think it's an interesting contradiction about this character.
Yeah.
And you also get the sense this guy's really been beaten down by life for some time. It doesn't seem like he's had a job in a very long time.
Right. He was a roadie for Metallica.
And then just been kind of kicking around
right.
for a while.
Right.
So you get the sense he's had to work very hard to kind of accept his place in life. Mm-hmm. He seems like he's smarter than just the kind of the life he's been put into.
He is yeah. content at the start of the movie, though.
That
he but, right
he had found some place of contentment.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that is because of the hard, because it is hard work to be Zen. Mm-hmm. And I think it does show all the hard work he puts into it,
mm-hmm.
even if that's required maybe on some level kind of renouncing earthly things and
that
earthly
he
pleasures.
Be unemployed and not have
that
a
he,
job.
Right, that he has to be unemployed. He has to be basically like an ascetic.
Right.
But it is a perfect contrast with Walter, who is this much, much higher energy, much right. angrier, much more hairy trigger finger sort right. of character. Jackie.
Yeah. Much. I didn't dislike it at all. I just wasn't like, ooh, I love that. Which I kind of... I kind of expected to like it more. It's really funny. I'm assuming I know this, but I have not seen it before, along with no other Coen Brothers movies. Okay. So I think my expectation...
Part of the fun of having Jackie's my co-host, she's seeing every single one of these movies.
That's awesome.
Fresh eyes.
So let's get into this. Yeah, I want to hear this.
So when I was watching it, I had like a certain conception of it that I was like, oh, I expected certain things to just sort of happen, because while I didn't know specific plot points, there's always like references to the Big Lebowski. So
right.
I even like imagined like the Big Lebowski's house to be different. Like I expected it to be like a modern, like really dope kind of setting. Although I guess that was Jackie Treehorn's place.
Mm-hmm.
So when that was not what I thought it was, I was like, oh, okay, that's not really what I thought. And then I do like dude movies, like guy movies, I think, because mm-hmm. I've like when I was younger, I was always like tomboyish and I have brothers and stuff. So it's not like I don't like guy stuff.
Right. This is a buddy movie for sure.
It is yeah. a buddy. It's a buddy comedy.
Well, so like I was talking to Laura, my cousin, and she watched it recently too. She's like, yeah, I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. And I was like, oh, okay. But then I talked to her about it yesterday. I was like, yeah, I was kind of like, I think I'm with you. And she's like, yeah, I kind of felt like it was hard to relate to, which was maybe my problem too. But there was nothing to me that was like bad about it. I wasn't even thinking like, oh, that's so unrealistic, even though clearly like, the whole movie
this is not supposed to be a realistic movie.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, a big one of the soundboard like bites that I have. That's so unrealistic.
Yeah.
And that's my complaint. That complaint specifically goes to like unrealistic relationships.
Right.
Which
it's
there are a few.
It's really
here.
Stylized even relationship wise.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, well, like for instance, Maude Lebowski. How yeah. do you feel about Maude Lebowski?
Maude Lebowski ain't gonna be into little or middle Lebowski. Like, I don't think that's gonna happen. But that wasn't even like a complaint. Like, I
well,
found it enjoyable.
Yeah. Though
but
you do find out that she only slept with him because
right.
she wants a baby, and she wanted to make sure she slept with someone who was, wouldn't
yeah.
like follow up yeah. or anything.
Yeah.
That's really what makes her like kind of, I think, an interesting female character with some agency. She's essentially this like kind of scam artist who, like a lot of the characters of this film, see the dude as this passive character who they could exploit for their own ends. And so
yeah.
The first thing we see is her knocking him out. And you right. got to assume she's probably giving him some sort of physical check as she's knocked
right.
out. And mm-hmm. then demands he go see a doctor, and then immediately says, you know, Jeffrey, love me.
But like a lot yeah. of Coen Brothers movies, this is like a really male-centric movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, there's only two female characters.
Sure.
Which is like always my complaint.
Right.
Not because I think the women need more screen time, but because I think they're like that muse or like Manic Pixie Dream Girl
right.
kind of character.
And it's not like a Buddy Lebowski is a particularly flattering female character.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Which like, I mean, I don't care, because I'm not like approaching it from this perspective of like, you know, all the women better be like real respectful, like, you know, good examples of women, mm-hmm. and there better be more screen time for women. I don't really care about that. I just, like, I really like human connections to make sense. And right. so in a lot of the movies, I don't really see that moment where I see, like, why would Verna be interested in this guy in Rose Crossing? Or, like, you know, what's her face in Barton Fink? I forget.
Oh, yeah. What her name is. Yeah, Judy Davis.
Yeah, whoever her character's name is. So there's just, like, moments where I want to see more of that. That really, I mean, it wasn't a complaint for me in this one because I didn't even expect that to happen. So there's sort of, like, low-grade things that maybe... You know, well, I didn't love it for those reasons.
Well, first of all, you're wrong. But second of all,
right? Of course, I'm wrong.
More than most Coen Brothers movies, I think this is one that grows on every single repeat rewatch.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's true. So what I'm saying is, as an initial watch, it's just not. It doesn't like affect you that much. I don't think. Maybe that's what it is. It's like it's enjoyable, and I don't have any major complaints.
Because to be able to pick up on like all these rhyming dialogue and the way different scenes complement each other, and I think
I think even the bigger part is like the symbolism of like what the movie means. I think if you just watch it one time, you're not picking up on like the yin and the yang and the kind of Taoist feeling and all that.
And that's what makes it a cult movie. I think that's what defines a lot of cult movies is that it exists in this world that is kind of bigger than the movie itself. And you can go live in that world by watching the movie over and over.
It's a great hangout movie. It might be their best just hangout movie where you're like, I love spending time with these characters and going to it's Jesus. Oh, it's Jackie Treehorn.
Jesus is my favorite part of the movie.
Jesus is like everybody's Christ, favorite part of the movie.
Yeah. but I also like love Totoro. Ugh. Anyway, so.
Oh, yeah. He does he make the most out of what's basically just one great introduction and then one other scene.
It's maybe the most surreal element of the movie, too, because he never affects the plot. And,
no.
Yeah.
It's just like something they talk about, which I thought was funny, too, because it's like, he's a horrible sex offender, so it's like kind of funny to talk
about. But he does affect what these characters care most about, which is the bowling tournament.
Right.
And that is another great contrast, too, is there is this... you know, absurdly complicated plot going through the movie with all these different characters who are all affecting each other in different ways.
Right.
But Walter definitely, but even like the dude seemed to care like as much about this bowling tournament as they do about all the ins and outs of this plot.
Mm.
Yeah, that I think they kind of have this huge complicated machine of a plot. And then what makes it really surreal is that the characters aren't that invested in the machinery of the plot.
They're like, we're caught up in this plot. We're just kind of being pushed from place to place.
Yeah.
The dude is a very, very passive character. Right. And people just kind of keep pushing him to do different things.
But I have a question about that. Oh,
yes.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, okay, so my question, or I guess comment too, is I didn't really catch the moment where the dude finally realized like what was really going on. It was like... suddenly he knew what it was, and he's like, "This is what's happening. That's what's happening."
Oh no! The moment was when Maud said that the Big Lebowski doesn't actually have any money, and he goes, "Oh man, my thinking about this has been so uptight." Wait a second.
Yeah. Okay.
He did have kind of a eureka moment.
Right. But even though that doesn't really matter.
Like, and even that came right after. Maude Lebowski says, "Oh, this exercise increases the chances of conception,"
and he has a killer
spit take.
Spit take was amazing. That was great. Yeah, but I guess I see that's when it was. It's just the part that seemed unrealistic is that like that epiphany affected him in that way. Well, I guess I don't know. Maybe he's just so passive and numb all the time that he's like not really noticing things going on. Mm-hmm. Although I did like that it was like, Walter was like right about a lot of stuff.
He was right about a lot of stuff.
That was great because I was like, this asshole needs to shut up. It's getting really annoying. And then I was like, oh, okay, no, he knows what's happening.
Right.
For so much of the movie, he was like, just trust. You were right. She kidnapped herself. Just trusted the plan.
Right.
And he's the one that's like, they're going to kill that poor woman.
Right.
Yeah.
I think in a typical movie, what happens is the plot is like the call to action for the protagonist.
Yeah.
And then the protagonist gets like spun through the plot, and that's the things that happen are what causes that person to change.
Right.
And in this movie, it's so different because the dude's goal is not to change and not to be affected by what's happening.
Yeah.
So he is in a weird meta way, he's actually like resisting the very idea of a movie structure,
right.
Which is that the protagonist would get affected by stuff.
Roger Ebert in this write-up on this said, this isn't a movie that's about a story as much as it's about an attitude and a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I think that goes into how, you know, the Coens themselves like treat the story. A driver to take us into funny scene after funny scene, but almost in many ways an afterthought.
I think it's the comedy flip side of The Matrix. of the 90s. Because The Matrix is the same, but in the genre of like an action movie. And I think all of that plot that's in The Matrix, and there's so much plot in that movie, it's crazy. It's just to get at the philosophy of all these like archetypal characters.
Oh, okay. So in that sense, where it's, you know, it's kind of like a philosophical treatise that just happens to have this plot going along with it as well. I can see that.
Okay, but can I ask you guys a question? So, and it's for each of you too. So for me, that's why I kind of wasn't like speaking up as much in the beginning of it, because I know I was not picking up on deeper philosophies after one watch.
And look, I mean, I think the Coens themselves would say we're probably reading way too much into this film.
Right,
I think they set out to make a funny book.
They would hate listening to this.
Right. That's what gets me to my question. Right. So it's like, when I watched it, I was like, all right, that was chill. But I wasn't like, damn, that was like a Coen Brothers movie that usually like gets me like really going and like, you know, thinking about all these deep things. I was just like, oh, that was fun. All right,
and
cool.
I think
but what about you guys? What
sure.
I want to know, first of all, when did you first watch it? What was your initial reaction? How many more times did you watch it? And like, how many people did you talk to about who are also, you know, followers of the dude to like figure out this is what's happening?
Okay. Yeah. I watched it freshman year of college. I instantly loved it. I watched it like two more times within the next week or so. This is a movie that really made me fall in love with the Coen brothers.
Okay. But immediately. So what was, you watched it once. What did you think
was
happening?
And my immediate reaction, and still honestly a huge part of my reaction now, look, we've got this Coen brothers podcast to dissect these movies, but I think this isn't necessarily a movie that requires dissection.
Well, we just did a lot of dissection actually that gave it a lot more meaning.
We did a lot, but
big time.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And it's there if you want to look for it, but really this is, I think the reason this became a cult classic is because you've got like a scene where the dude got sucked up inside a bowling ball, and you've got Walter saying, "This is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass." And
okay, but is
Jackie
that what
Treehorn's
you loved?
Ridiculous pool party, and I
like. Why did you keep watching it? Like, you watched it once, and then you're like, "Why do I have to keep watching this movie? What's so amazing about it?"
I love hanging out with these characters. I love the surrealism. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned
the movie's over. We're back to freshman year in your dorm room.
Yeah. Right. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. The final shot is a strike that blacks out.
Yeah.
And then what does young Josh say immediately in that moment out loud to himself?
I think it was honestly just like, that was hilarious. I don't think I was thinking on any sort of deep
the
level.
The comedy of it.
I was like, man, just there's so many funny lines, and I want to go back and, because I think even then it was a huge rewatcher of everything. But like, I want to go back and like see just these funny scenes again on a comedy level. And it does hit just a lot of weird personal flashpoints to me, which is that weird plot twist and funny Jew jokes and surrealism in L.A. This might be the best movie about Los Angeles ever made. And that's a crazy thing to say, possibly, but it feels...
I think Crash was more like... Sorry.
No. Don't even say that in jest. Jesus Christ. It feels more like the city I grew up in, I think, than any other movie about Los Angeles.
Did you grow up in L.A.?
I did grow up in L.A.
Wow. So
I did, too.
I mean, that is a whole other level, because I saw it before I'd ever been to L.A.
Right.
Mm. And actually, this is the first time I've rewatched it having lived in L.A., and that gave it a whole other layer.
Yeah, it's like now you know Ralph's and In and Out and all these things. And when they're referring to L.A., the In and Out on Radford and North Hollywood. It's so specific.
Yes.
And also, you know, the fact this is just kind of this weird assemblage of different characters and artists and just bizarre people. And that is what L.A. is like. The fact that you keep going to all these different little enclaves. L.A. is kind of a million little cities in one, a million little subcultures, and this touched on a whole bunch of them.
Okay, so then when you watched it a second and third time, then is that when you started paying attention to the other parts of it?
Yeah, that's when I started being like, okay, there's maybe some interesting things being said here about, the 60s, and about how we deal with hardships in our life and things like that. But the beauty of this film, and I think the reason it did become a cult classic, is you don't need any of those things to appreciate it.
But it seems like that's what everyone's really into.
I see what you're saying, because I feel like the more I watch it, the more I'm likely to go on and on about what Josh and I have just been going on and on about.
Yeah.
Right. But I think like when I first watched it, I just was like, that was funny. I liked it. There's like boobs in it. I don't know.
Exactly. Like
now I know why guys get into this movie.
Look, naked girls on a trampoline and log jamming and I'll suck your cock for $1,000.
Right.
And
Terry.
And yes, and all the
Tara Reid.
And all the swearing and okay. and shut the fuck up, Donnie, and all this, and just if you're
yeah, that's dude stuff.
If you're a teenage boy, dude, stuff
it's such
funny.
A guy yeah. movie, okay. and there's so yeah. many like.
That's
just
what
on,
it is.
On a surfacey level, I could see like last night there was a 16-year-old. Boy who watched this movie for the first time and was like, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's ultimately a huge part of why right. this movie's gonna live on.
Yeah. See, I think that must be what's gotten like more guys yeah. into this to like even dissect and get into it. Not that I know, because I don't talk about the Big Lebowski a lot with like women or whatever. I mean, all dudes are like Big Lebowski, Big Lebowski. You know, on J Swipe, little Jewish Tinder, just to yeah. make a little segue.
Yeah. J Swipe.
You like
Jay's wipe.
It pulls up people's like likes on Facebook and stuff to fill yeah. in, you know, like the movies that they like specifically. I cannot tell you how many Jewish dudes put the Big Lebowski as one of their favorite movies. That's just like such a dude.
I mean, beyond the Jew jokes, I think there is an element of kind of. Well, in all the Coen Brothers movies, there's an element of Jewish yeah. comedy implicit.
Yes.
And when we get to A Serious Man, which I'm sorry you couldn't be here to talk about, we're really going to get
yeah,
into that.
For sure.
But,
You should get a rabbi in here to talk about
We should
about
get a rabbi in for
man
A Serious Man. Yeah, we really
I bet
should.
You that, that's
Wait,
a movie
I'll get
rabbis
somebody really
love.
Jewish.
You should get somebody really Jewish for that movie. That would
Guys,
be great.
All right, I'll work on that.
Jackie, is there a movie that you like watch in the same way that we clearly watch Big Lebowski?
I'm trying to think what movie. So here's, for me, what's weird too is like a movie would be like my favorite movie. I'd be, oh, this is one of my favorite movies. And then like I forget everything that happened in it. When I was younger, I loved Cruel Intentions. I watched it so many times, and it was like one of few movies I could like recite lines out of. But that like really appealed to like teenage me. I don't know what that says about me now, but I don't think.
Yeah, maybe
a
that's a movie I didn't totally understand.
I think maybe if I rewatch that
line,
we should have like a little special episode about Cruel Intentions
sure.
and compare it to the Coen Bros. I can tell you what it is now, but I think rewatching it now, I could probably explain what it is I like about it. So that's I have to get back to you on that. But I don't really think I have like a Big Lebowski type movie in my life. I just rewatch Sex and the City a lot, the TV show,
yeah,
not the movie. The movies are fine.
I love this movie, but I've never been to a Lebowski fest, and I don't know right. if I necessarily. I think
I would for the White Russians because yeah. so
Sex and the City though. That's I think that is a good example because it is this kind of similar kind of cult style
for
thing.
Women.
I've actually my ex girlfriend and I watched the whole show, so I've seen every.
And episode you know it's pretty good though, right?
It is really good.
Aha! Finally, sorry.
And it is like Big Lebowski. It's like a philosophy based thing.
Yeah.
You have these four main characters who all have their own really specific point of view mm-hmm. on the world.
Yeah.
And then the whole show revolves around that, and yeah. I think that.
And they like
kind
evolve
of is a similar
change.
Style to how Big Lebowski works.
I can
and
see
it's also
that.
Like female oriented.
That philosophy might be kind of obnoxious, but
no, you know what? You're judging, but you don't really know it because, by the way, my ex boyfriend who got me the whole set of it, which is like one of the best gifts I've ever received ever, because I don't like presents.
I've seen
that much.
Three episodes of Sex and the City, yeah, so I'm no expert.
It's great though because it's actually like a good show, and even he yeah. was like, it's like pretty good because there's character development.
Yeah,
that's great.
At its best, it's got amazing characters and character development. At its yeah. worst, it is like so
annoying to guys.
Awful.
I know. Yeah. But the thing that you gotta know about that show is that like it's so relatable because women, we are crazy, and so I'm just saying like those things that come out of nowhere. When I heard Darren Star speak like just like a couple weeks ago, and somebody asked him like, "Oh, so like what have you learned about you know writing for women's shows?" Because he's done so many other ones too, and he's mm-hmm. like, "You could make," he's like, "You could make anything up, and it's true, right. and that is true." Like. If you can imagine it for a woman, it has happened. And I really like that Sex and the City definitely captures that. Even
Jackie, though, I think we figured it out. We're doing the Sex and the City podcast next.
I think we're going to, and I'm so excited about it. We're going to have the best guest ever. You're going to have to watch every single episode.
God.
And we do it one.
Oh, God.
I call the scene no. where I call the episode where Carrie goes into the country. And just can't handle the country life.
I love and hate that episode.
That
because,
is one of the most annoying episodes.
Right, so, and I, yeah. that's the thing about it is it evokes that like annoyance in you too if mm-hmm. you're a sane person. So, oh, sorry for the Sex and the City tangent.
It's okay, gosh. No.
But that is something that I would say, yeah, I'll relate to that and rewatch it. And yeah, it's great. So,
well, look,
that's my Big Lebowski, guys.
Well, look, I relate to Jeff Bridges as the dude. I do find him an extremely relatable character,
mm-hmm.
and I think that might be part of why I loved it at first too. Is he's not a typical hard boiled detective protagonist, even though he's in that story,
right?
You notice sometimes he will say lines like, where Mott Lebowski says, you could guess where Logjammin' goes from here. And he says, he fixes the cable.
Oh, yeah, that was, like, so great.
Which are, you know, funny lines like that, but also lines like, you could hear, like, in a different movie, like, right. Humphrey Bogart saying it in kind of that hard-boiled cadence.
Mm-hmm. He's such a Miranda. He really is.
Jesus Christ.
Jeff is a Miranda? No. Opposite.
But that he is this kind of atypically masculine protagonist who's kind of just feeling his way through life and going at the flow from one situation to another, point, and I found that relatable. Yeah.
At one point, he's asked to define what being a man is,
yeah.
And he says it's like having testicles. I can't remember
right.
the exact
exactly.
quote.
It's like, well, I've got, yeah, exactly, right. I've got balls, I'm a man, right. you know?
Yeah, there was something with that. I was trying to think of the exact line, but I couldn't.
Because I think the big Lebowski is talking about, like, how being a man is, like, you know, all this typical yeah. masculine stuff.
Yeah, and also very kind of like 80s and early 90s Reaganomics. And,
right.
Yeah, there's definitely a political critique right. in there, too. Did you know that a lot of the dude's wardrobe was just Jeff Bridges' wardrobe?
Oh, that's awesome.
Including the jelly shoes.
including the jelly shoes and like shoes. And just the robe and yeah, the oversized clothing. And it's so perfect.
It's great.
Just that reminds me of something too, is Walter. I really love that he stayed Jewish even though he was divorced.
Uh-huh.
And I love that the dude like calls him out on that and he's like, you divorced? He's like, so like I still converted. And it's also funny because there's a little Sex in the City tie-in too, because Charlotte converts, and then for a Jewish guy, and then they break up. Mm-hmm. Don't ugh. This is not an ugh moment. Get out of here.
This
God.
Is real.
Why don't you make your own soundboard so you can say ugh when I talk about Sex in the City? But she also converts for the guy, and then they break up, but then she's like still observing it, and all her friends are like, well, why are you still doing this? And she's like, what? I converted. Like, I'm a Jew now. And then she was only going to temple to find men. It was great. So I just,
I mean, it's
I
a
love
question.
Seeing
what
that
do,
again.
It's a good question. What do you do in that scenario? Do you just like, okay, I renounce this
well,
faith that
so
he picked
far,
up a couple years ago?
So far, the two characters that I can, you know, in pop culture that I can call out for that have decided to stay Jewish, and I respect that.
Yeah,
it's funny.
One great point that I saw in a take online was that a lot of this movie does seem to be about nihilism. Beyond the fact that there are kind of nihilists in this film, right. You could be interpreted. It could be interpreted as this post 60s critique of after the big revolution, the baby boomer revolution. We've now gotten to a point in the 90s where it seems like all that was for naught, all that work has been undone, and maybe it seems like nothing really matters.
Right.
And the fact that so little attention is paid to the story almost does give that give the movie that through line that none of these things really matter, and nobody's really all that invested in this.
I love that they were just like an actual little group of nihilists, because
right.
it's funny.
But you've got Walter, especially, as the guy who can't accept that, and still
right.
feels like, you know, post-Vietnam, there's got to be something that matters. I'm clinging
right.
desperately to anything that matters. And
right.
you could see his Judaism in that light.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, 3,000 years of tradition from Moses to Sandy Koufax. You're goddamn right I'm living in the past.
Right.
And he is living in the past. And he admits it.
Right.
Yeah. That was great. That was
great. It's funny because we talked earlier about how, Jackie, you said it seemed like a lot of work to be kind of a Taoist the way that the dude seems to be. But
yeah.
there's also a little moment where he's at the Big Lebowski's mansion
mm-hmm.
and he sees one of the nihilists sleeping in the pool and someone just says, oh, he's a nihilist. or it's Tara Reid.
Yeah.
Right. And he goes, oh, yeah, that must be exhausting.
Yeah, that was a great yeah. line too. Yeah. That's so true.
The nihilists are pretty great across the board. Peter Stormare is, yeah, he is great.
God, I love him so much.
And ugh. Flea.
Flea is
yeah, he was good at him too.
Yeah. I knew that Flea was in this movie, but I didn't know until looking up some stuff that Amy Mann's in this movie.
Right.
As one of the nihilists' girlfriend who has the toe cut
off.
Oh,
the blondie.
Yeah.
And the nihilists are a band called Autobahn.
Yes.
Which is a nod to
Kraftwerk, which is perfect.
Right.
Yeah.
The soundtrack is so perfect.
Yeah.
Classic, just brilliant use of classic rock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
I mean, even more than like, this is probably their best soundtrack. If you don't count things like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is more like all this music was kind of made for the movie.
Right.
If you're just talking about like a pure jukebox film, this
right.
is their best jukebox
yeah.
film.
Inside Llewyn Davis is up there too, but again,
right.
not
it's this,
a...
It's
right.
a, it's a different thing. It's they made that music
right.
for the movie.
Fargo's music, lest we forget.
But
I got chills listening to our opening today, since
yeah.
now I know what it is.
But that too, that was, you know, that was a score and a great
right.
score.
Yeah,
but just
yeah,
in terms
a,
of like...
Totally, yeah,
all
totally
these,
different. I just wanted to
yeah.
yeah
the Coens, they definitely had a... They had Kenny Rogers doing Just Dropped In when in mind when they wrote the script.
Right.
And also mm-hmm. the Gypsy Kings doing Hotel California
mm-hmm.
to introduce Jesus.
Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah, it was a trip shot.
And then the Eagles come up later.
And the, I think it's like the one thing you actually hear him say he hates. You know, one thing you know about the dude, he says, "I hate the fucking Eagles."
Right.
And it says, yeah. It says so much.
Yeah. The Eagles are the antithesis of the dude's philosophy, even though it seems like they are very like chill and stuff, but it's like totally the bullshit corporate version.
It was literally the song "Peaceful Easy Feeling" was the song that was playing. Mm-hmm. It's just like just the most anodyne bullshit corporate rock. Mm-hmm. It's perfect. The music is perfect from front to back.
Yeah,
even starting out with "Tumbling Tumbleweeds," all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, T-Bone Burnett helping out with a lot of this.
He produced
the soundtrack. Speaking of the fucking Eagles line, the one song they had the toughest time getting the rights to was the cover of the Rolling Stones' "Dead Flowers" that closes out the movie.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And in order to convince him, T-Bone Burnett had to talk to the Rolling Stones' former manager, who I guess had the rights to that song.
Oh, that's annoying.
Showed him an early cut of the movie, and he wasn't sold until he got to the line, "I hate the fucking Eagles." And he's like, okay, you know what? All right.
Yeah, I'll get behind that.
All right, behind it.
Great.
So funny. Aw.
I want to give a word of praise to Steve Buscemi, who does a lot with a little here.
Yes.
Yeah, he has such a cutie pie in it.
His role is really interesting because he is kind of a prop. Mm-hmm. Like he is there to die at the end and kind of force that moment of connection, personal growth. Yeah,
poor
but
Donnie.
He is kind of this pawn, and I guess he's like the fool because he's an idiot.
Right. He never knows what's going on. Yeah.
But that's not his fault. No one's ever telling him what's going on.
Yeah. He tries to find out what's going on and they just say, "Shut the fuck up."
Yeah. And then like anytime he says something that's right, he's like, "Shut the fuck up, Donnie." And it's like, he's saying something that's correct. Like it's so well, poor guy.
Or he hears Lennon and says, "I am the walrus." You know, he's wrong most of the time.
Right, but I'm saying because he doesn't know the context of anything, it's like not his fault that he's wrong. You know, like it's not like he's like a total moron. He's not like he's not confusing something that's not Lennon. He's just thinking Lennon.
And it is another meta call out of the really complex plot that Donnie is just totally unable to follow a lot of
always
what's going on.
Always a step behind.
That's very true. Yeah, I'd be like the Donnie. Like, what's happening, guys?
And also, apparently, the whole "shut the fuck up, Donnie" thing was a meta nod to Buscemi's previous character in Fargo, who never shut up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. It's like...
Wait, the Coen brothers have said that?
The Coen brothers have said that,
I love that.
They're like, last time Steve Buscemi would never stop talking. This time we're going to have a character where he barely says anything.
Oh, that's so just cool. I love meta stuff like that.
It is... I love that, too. There's just... We really could talk about this forever. There's so many layers and so many fun things going on.
Yeah, the more you watch it, the more layers there are. That is the clear conclusion here.
And I really do recommend, Jackie, you need to see it again.
I'll make you
more White Russians.
Another movie I watched really recently is Kingpin. Mm-hmm. Have you guys
another
seen
classic
that?
Bowling film,
which is another great bowling movie that came out in 1996 with Bill Murray and Woody Harrelson and mm-hmm. Randy Quaid, and it's a Farrelly Brothers movie. So it's really like raunchy and mm-hmm. dirty and stuff.
Oh yeah, Kingpin is great.
But there is a lot. There are a lot of similarities. I really recommend like watching both of these and kind of drawing lines between.
I should
them.
Watch Kingpin again.
Did they copy Kingpin then?
Well, Kingpin did come first, didn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Ooh, convenient.
But I mean, they're totally different movies. But like, in a way, they kind of have similar things of bowling being this. Kind of like meditative sport that doesn't really have a purpose besides just to be bowling.
Just a fun thing people do.
And it's also exercise.
I guess kind of.
It's
pretty light exercise, but it's exercise.
In researching
it's
my quiz. It is a sport.
More exercise than chess.
I think it's like anaerobic even. But I looked it up because I was looking up quiz facts and it was like, yep, it's a sport. It like works your body. So, just saying.
It actually made me think of, I don't know if you've ever heard of the book Bowling Alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which traced, you know, the peak of bowling leagues in America was like in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
It was a community activity that a lot of people did together. And he used the decline of bowling leagues to just trace the lack of, you know, community association in Americans in general. And the fact that we're all just much more alone.
Right.
I guess we just all play virtual bowling with each other now. It's not this, but it's not the same.
Here we go.
And it does work in this movie as kind of this, again, another kind of anachronistic tie to this world of the 60s
mm-hmm.
that a lot of the characters are living in that isn't coming back.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
That is kind of sad.
The decline of bowling. Okay,
we should go bowling, guys.
We should. Some of the facts I wanted to say. A lot of these characters were inspired by real-life figures, not just the dude, but Walter was largely inspired by John Milius, the director of Conan the Barbarian.
Mm. Okay.
Who's also a huge gun nut. And would have like things like Uzis and stuff. Jesus is partly inspired by Roman Polanski. No joke.
Wow.
Yeah, it kind of explains a lot.
Okay.
Maude Lebowski is partly inspired by Yoko Ono.
Okay. Mm. Yeah.
And you can see how you know the Coens I think kind of created this world, and I think they said they really wanted to set this at L.A. because when they were writing the scripts, they got all this inspiration from characters that they would meet in contemporary Los Angeles and mm-hmm. wanted to kind of tie them all together into a story.
Is
part of why this is such a brilliant just LA movie and feels like a Los Angeles movie.
Yeah, I definitely felt like home watching it.
And in the original script, the dude's car was a Chrysler LeBaron, but Goodman couldn't fit into it, so they changed it to a Ford Torino. And one last fact before we go to our quiz. Branded is a real TV show. I thought they made it up for the
movie.
I thought they made it up for the movie.
180 some episodes. It actually only
ran for like 50 or 60 episodes, but it was a real Western. And when he sings the Branded theme song, that's the real theme song to Branded.
Oh, that's so cute.
That's such a weird moment when they go to that guy's house and
he's in the iron lung.
And you'd think if he made that TV show, he'd be in a way nicer house. But it's kind of a modest house in the valley.
Yeah. Hey, maybe he spent all of his money on that iron lung. Healthcare. Yeah. Healthcare is expensive, dude, guys.
That's probably what it is.
Anyway, final thoughts. We'll go around, but just my final thought on this film. I love pretty much every aspect of this film, and it's a huge... It's been a huge influence just on who I am and my own personal sense of humor and my own movie-watching tastes, and... is one of the major reasons the Coen brothers are my favorite directors. I don't have much more to say about it than that, because it will just end up being me quoting more lines from the movie if I can remember them.
Okay, I think my thoughts are like pretty clear, which is that I think
I'll
it was
allow it.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Can I just talk?
Yes.
Can I just talk? Yes. Thank you. Okay. No, I thought it was super enjoyable. I totally see why it's a movie that dudes probably rewatch more than dudettes do. So I liked it. I may watch it some more. I dig the themes we talked about today. Overall, enjoyable film. Not my favorite Coen Brothers movie, though.
Fair enough.
Like, I liked Blood Simple better.
you're a crazy person. Thomas?
So when Donnie dies, they go to pick up his ashes from the mortuary.
Mm-hmm.
And behind the... on the wall, you can see there's this quote from Psalms.
Uh-huh.
And
that's right.
I'll just read that and leave you with that. As for man, his days are grass. As a flower of the field, so he flourishes. For the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more.
It's beautiful, man. Beautiful. And with that, it's time for our final segment. It's called Raising Arizona. I just realized we didn't even mention Sam Elliott. Who has such a strange role in this film.
Yeah.
And such an amazing mustache.
He gives it... He does that classic Coen Brothers thing, which makes it like a story within a story or whatever.
I mean, they've definitely done like narrators who are barely connected to the story before. They did that in Hudsucker Proxy, among others. But this is the first time it's just a straight up like looking at the camera and winking.
Right.
I'm just here to narrate the story. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's perfect, though.
It's just a really surreal... touch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it means.
I don't know either.
It might not mean anything.
Exactly. I don't know what it means, but it's funny.
Yeah, it is really funny. And Sam Elliott kills it.
And there's like a mustache made out of yarn.
It was so weird.
God, I wish I could grow that.
Yeah. I don't think he did. Do you think he did?
Yeah.
Really?
It's like his trademark, because he could grow that. That's the only reason he gets roles. He's got that mustache.
But even the part on the side? I guess so. On top, it looked real to me, but like on the sides, it looked like yarn.
It's a handlebar mustache.
Okay, fair.
That's how you do it. You grow it like that.
Fair.
So, our final segment is where we have a quiz with a theme inspired by the movie of the week. to test our knowledge. And Thomas, you and I will be facing off on, against each other in some questions that Jackie is feeding us.
Great. Yeah, hopefully. Well,
who came up with these questions?
Jackie
I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, usually Josh does it. I did one. I feel like that quiz was very hard, so this one's probably not going to be as hard. But cool. So we get some satisfaction out of guessing. All right, guys. Number one, bowling dates back to what time period? A, the Middle Ages. B, the 17th century. Or C, ancient Egypt.
Middle Ages, 17th century, ancient Egypt.
I mean, just shout out the answer when you know it. Or you can say ding, too. Whatever.
Is that... I don't know. I mean, it seems like a game that could have been around since ancient Egypt. Just put some sticks up and roll out like a rock into it. I'm going to say ancient Egypt.
Okay.
I'm going to say 17th century.
Josh gets a point.
Yeah!
It's ancient Egypt. So yeah, the earliest, most primitive forms of bowling can be dated back to ancient Egypt and the Roman Empire. From records and artifacts in ancient Egypt, remnants of bowls used at the time were found.
You could probably, I bet they have like hieroglyphs of like some guy throwing a rock into a bunch of pins.
Very possible.
Knocking shit down.
That's all the bowling oldest, is. The oldest game, knocking things over.
Right.
Yeah. Number two, bowling is often depicted in popular culture. True or false? Bowling frequently showed up in Dutch Golden Age paintings.
Well, okay. If it's been around since ancient Egypt...
You don't
Egypt,
have to do then. Your thought process out loud, because you're stealing other people's thought process.
Okay, fine. I'll be silent then. I'm going to just sit here
I'm just saying.
Okay, one thing I know about that time period of painting is that it was all about rich people kind of like showing their lives and showing how they could like enjoy leisure and stuff like that.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with true. That sounds true to me.
Okay. I'm going to say false because I don't think bowling was a rich person's sport. I think it was a peasant sport.
Mm.
It's true. But it was in Dutch Golden Age paintings, and from what I was seeing, it was like peasants bowling.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you guys are both like...
But you still get the point tonight.
I get a full point,
yeah.
And Josh gets a moral point.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys
I have the moral upper hand.
moral high ground, if you will. Okay, so you guys each have 1 point.
This is tough.
Oh, I'm glad you think so. It's so exciting for me. Which of the following is not a type of bowling? A, 8-pin bowling. B, candle pin bowling, or C, duck pin bowling.
Can I ask you what a candle pin or a duck pin is?
No. I can explain after.
Okay.
I'm going to say 8 pins, because I just can't imagine the configuration. Oh, no. Well, yeah, I can't imagine a configuration that would have 8 pins.
Maybe a triangle that's missing the back 2 corners? So you don't have to, so you can't get a 7-10 split?
Uh-huh.
Maybe.
I'm going to go with 8-pin bowling.
Actually, I'm actually going to agree with Thomas on this and say 8-pin bowling.
You guys are smart. I was hoping somebody would get it because of the math issue, because it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different... There's like 10-pin, there's 12-pin, there's like different ones, but 8
5-pin
doesn't work.
Is popular in Canada.
Oh, good thing I didn't put...
5-pin bowling as a kid.
God, good thing I didn't put that one down.
Wait, I was going to say, I could see 6-pin, yeah, but 5-pin but seems like that would be...
And it had really small balls.
Oh, it's so cute.
I used to play bumper bowling a lot.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, nice.
Holler, 90s kids. Yeah, candle pin bowling is like with the tallest pins, thin with matching ends, and bowled with the smallest and lightest handheld ball of any bowling sport. And duck pin bowling has short, squat pins and bowled with a handheld ball. Not quite sure what that means.
As opposed to a ball that you kick?
Maybe.
Yeah, there wasn't enough description. But
it just doesn't have holes, so you're like gripping it with your forehand.
Right. Have you ever played bocce ball?
Yes.
Bocce ball is kind of fun.
Oh my god!
I was gonna make some bocce ball questions, and then I didn't.
Oh, well.
It's a type of bowling.
Yeah.
When and where? Number four. So you guys each have 2 points.
Yes, we both have 2 points, but I have 1 moral point.
Right,
right, and that makes you win.
that
means you win at all forever. Number four: when and where were the first indoor bowling lanes built? A. Liverpool, England, in 1815. B. New York City in 1840. C. Chicago, Illinois, in 1989.
It can't be 1989.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, 1899.
Okay.
Yeah, 18. That was a good point.
I picked that one.
I'm going to say Liverpool.
I picked Chicago.
Y'all are both wrong.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's New York City, 1840.
Ooh. Okay.
All right.
Those New Yorkers and that boy.
Yeah. That's why I tried to do like similar time periods because I was like, someone's going to pick
wrong. I was going to say 1989. You could, yeah.
Yeah, actually, okay, so fair. I actually wrote 1900 on it at first, but then as I was reading it aloud, I was like, that's too much of a round number. And then I said it wrong.
That's
aloud. What is, okay, so number five, you guys still each have 2 points. What is the minimum weight for a bowling ball? A, 6 pounds. B, 4.5 pounds. C, no minimum weight.
I'm tempted to say no minimum weight, but could you have like a 1 pound bowling ball? Would that even work?
I'm going to say 6 pounds. 4.5 seems so light.
I'm going to say no minimum weight.
Yeah, Josh gets a point.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that was a weird fact. All right, 3-2.
So like the tissue paper ball just floats down to the bins.
Until the early 1900s, bowling balls were typically made out of what material? A, weighted leather. B, weighted wood. C, porcelain composite.
Okay, I know I shouldn't be saying my thoughts out loud because I'm going to give some of the clues, but I don't know. A porcelain ball might just break.
It's a porcelain composite.
But it's a composite.
Right, so maybe it's tougher than real porcelain. But weighted leather? I don't think you would make up weighted leather if weighted leather wasn't the real thing. So I'm going to say weighted leather.
I'm going to go with weighted leather.
Y'all are suckers.
Oh,
B, wood.
Damn it.
And I did make up weighted leather. I was like, this sounds like a thing. Because I was
okay,
like, footballs.
Fine. You fooled me. You fooled me.
I love it.
You should play
people.
Balderdash. That's all that game is. It's like coming up with fake definitions for words.
Oh, I would be good at
that. But that's the whole
that.
Thing is like coming up with
oh
really
God.
Convincing of like... Yeah. No one could have made up weighted leather. That's too real.
Me. Oh, I love that.
You basically
I love...
just balderdashed us.
Oh, that's so great. Because I love Premise Lawyer, too, for that same reason.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. All right. I have a new game that I like. It's called Balderdash.
Haven't even played yet.
Yeah, but I love it. Number seven. Oh, wait. So we're still at 3-2.
Yep.
Where is the largest bowling center with 141 lanes located? A, Japan. B, Las Vegas. C, United Arab Emirates.
Man, it could conceivably be any one of those three.
Yeah. I'm going to go Vegas. I feel like it's got to be Vegas.
It sounds like a Japan thing. Because it sounds like too big to be a bowling alley. And that sounds like a Japan thing. Like, ridiculously big.
Okay. Josh gets a point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I Las totally Vegas is second biggest.
Wow.
Yeah. So you were close. I was hoping somebody would pick UAE, but I guess not.
I mean, I could totally see it.
Yeah.
Probably have some giant bowling alley there. With like golden pins.
Yeah. Okay. So 4-2. Number 8. The youngest person to ever bowl a 300 was 10 years and 2 months old when he did so. Where was he from? A, Prague, Czech Republic. B, I can't say this, Reykjavik, Iceland, or C, Columbus, Ohio.
Was he some little American prodigy?
I'm going to go Columbus, Ohio, USA.
America.
Yeah. I'm going to say Iceland.
Nope. It's Columbus, Ohio.
Yes. Yes.
So we're still tied? We're tied again?
No, 3-4.
3-4.
I needed that point.
Two more
now
points.
I'm one away.
All right, guys. Yeah, America for real. Number 9. What is the maximum number of holes allowed in a bowling ball? A, 7 holes. B, 12 holes. C, 9 holes.
What? Why would you need 12 holes in a bowling ball?
There's no rule for minimum weight, but there's a rule on maximum amount of holes.
Well, probably because if you had too many holes, then the ball wouldn't function
properly.
Right,
then properly. It's not even a ball anymore at a certain point.
But what do you
it's
need
like
more
a beehive.
Than 3 holes for?
So 4 people can throw a ball together?
What were the answers? 7, 9, and 12?
Yeah.
But all of those are crazy. I reject this entire question.
Well, you know what? There is like, okay, there's like 3 holes on one side and then there's like a thumb hole on the other. So that's 4.
No, there's... Aren't there 3 total?
On a usual bowling ball, I think there's 4.
I thought there's 3.
Yeah, there's 3, right?
Maybe.
Yeah, there's 3.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, because it's like your pointer finger, your middle finger, and your thumb.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to say it's a multiple of three, so I'm going to go with nine. Though I guess 12 is also a multiple of three. I'm going to say nine.
I'm going to go seven. I'm just going to go the least amount of numbers.
It's 12, guys.
Really? Ugh.
Yeah.
So yeah, four I don't know sets of holes.
But why?
I don't know. That's just what it is. All right, last question. 4-3?
Yeah.
All right. This could be the game point or tie. Oh, wait, if it ties. All right. Okay. Anyway, number 10. In bowling lingo, a golden turkey refers to what? A, nine strikes in a row. B, a game of 200 or more. Or C, a game of exactly 200 made by alternating strikes and spares throughout the entire game.
What's it called again?
A golden turkey.
A golden turkey. What was the second option?
A game of 200 or more.
I don't think it's that. Maybe it's the strikes and spares.
A game of exactly 200 made by alternating strikes and spares throughout the entire game.
Sounds plausible. I'm going to say that.
I'm going to go with nine strikes in a row, because that would be three turkeys back to back.
No, so a golden turkey.
You do get it. Yeah, okay. You got the point. I didn't know if somebody would know the lingo, so
I don't.
Why
I clearly don't.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Because a turkey's three strikes.
Okay. Yeah, see, I didn't know if somebody would know that. Yeah, so now, it's a tie.
Whoa.
I don't even have a tiebreaker point.
You don't have a tiebreaker?
Wait, I'll get one real quick. Hold on. It's so easy.
Okay.
Bowling is so easy. Unless you don't want, unless you guys don't care who wins.
You guys ever get down to Chateau Lanes in Koreatown?
I've never been there.
That's a fun bowling alley. I recommend it.
The Lucky Strike is near here. That's the one I would go to. What's in Chateau Lanes?
It's just a really old school, like, run down place. It still has like a snack bar.
That's cool.
And billet, like, pool.
Yeah, I bowling should have a little bit of that grungy vibe.
It still has blowers for your hands.
Yeah, like, I feel like there should be like bowling hustlers around.
It's
super
grungy. There's definitely bowling hustlers.
Lucky Strike isn't the same thing. Lucky Strike's like half a club.
Yeah,
it is half a club. And it's like hard to get into sometimes.
And on the wall, oh man, they have it says Chateau Lanes for fun and health. That's like
see,
because
it's a sport. It's a sport.
Hey, maybe you should play.
Yeah,
like, good workout.
Yeah,
good for,
I'm
good
into
for,
it.
Good for my tries. Yeah, my buys and tries.
Let's go do that.
It also in smaller print it says we looked it up and it's anaerobic.
Okay,
they do say that, right? Yeah, that's what I said. It's anaerobic.
That's
exactly what I said.
Right below
in both English and Korean.
We looked it up. So here's our last question to see if we can do a tiebreaker. Okay.
All right.
So when did bowling make its television debut?
So wait! Don't tell us. Don't give us options.
So whoever gets
closest. Gets closest.
Okay.
That way we're.
So yeah, when did bowling make its television debut?
Do we want to do an over under kind of thing on this?
I think it's just whoever gets closest to the year. Yeah.
So should we say it at the same? I mean, we're allowing a certain amount of strategic.
Sure, we'll say it. We'll say it simultaneously.
Okay.
1, 2, 3.
1972.
You got it. Thomas got it. It's 50.
Was it?
1950.
Okay. Oh, wow. Early.
Yeah.
Earlier than I thought. Way earlier than I thought.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right.
So it looks like after all that, Thomas
wins. But I have the moral high ground.
Oh, sorry. This whole quiz
is
invalid. Yeah. Nope. He just automatically wins because he's got moral high ground.
Yeah, that's all that matters.
was a fun sport.
That was a fun sport. Thank you. Thank you. I feel
that was a fun mental sport, if you will.
I feel like I've exercised my brain, my bowling parts of my brain.
It's anaerobic. Uh-huh.
It is anaerobic. I'm not breathing. Guys, thank you, Thomas, for appearing on this episode of Accept
the
Mystery.
Thank you for having me, guys.
It was a real pleasure. Talking about a great, great film and talking about some bowling.
Very good layers.
Lots of layers.
I really liked the conversation, guys.
We had good conversation going. Mm-hmm. Thomas, where can we find you online if we want to find out any sort of projects you're up to?
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Thomas Ouellette. That's Ouellette.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, fine. You're up, and you're doing a bunch of, like, you know, indie improv shows, things like that all the time.
Our show's on hiatus now, but when it comes back, it's at the Clubhouse.
That's right, because the Clubhouse
Hollywood
is on hiatus. That's right.
Yeah.
On Wednesday nights.
But you know what? I've seen you, I just realized, doing play-by-play.
I have. We
yeah.
both seen
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we did. It was together, right? Oh. Yeah, we saw it. Play-by-play. Oh, cool. I love play-by-play, and then we did see Icky Pep, so...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, nice job handling that. Those are tough.
Yeah.
It seems like it's like
it does seem like it would be very difficult to do. With like people yelling out the ways you're doing things yeah. wrong as you're doing
Thomas
it.
Thomas coming out with a real strong introduction.
Yeah. That was fun.
That was awesome, yeah. I want to do that one day.
Jackie?
Yes.
What's your tweet of the week?
Oh, who cares? Find me on Tinder. no, I don't think
but,
I have a tweet.
Because people
this
people
week.
Can't find you on Tinder. You can't find somebody on Tinder. You just had to get lucky.
Yeah, just keep swiping until you find a Jackie. That's me. 26, almost 27 in a couple days.
Ooh, congratulations.
Thank you.
What day is your birthday?
September 2nd.
Cool, my birthday is September 6th.
Whoa.
We're almost twins, too.
Yeah.
You
guys are both...
Virgos.
I was going to say Sagittarius. I was close.
Oh, you are not close at all. Okay. Libra, then Sagittarius.
Got it.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at MacLean, MacQueline. I might, there's no at the end of that, but I might tweet something about...
MacLean.
MacLean. But I might tweet something about Tinder discoveries this week.
Do it. Tweet, just like post screenshots of the craziest things you find on Tinder. Is that like, does that like cross
I'm
some
not
sort
gonna
of,
do
does
that.
That cross some sort of like moral boundary?
First of all, I'm not going to embarrass myself that much publicly, but
I'm not talking about like your conversations. I'm talking about look at this guy's dumbass profile picture.
Nah, I think I have better things to do than shame people on Tinder. It's
that's
already
fair.
A shameful place to be. And then it raises the question, why are you there, you know?
Right.
Tinder's legitimate.
Why are you in this palace
of shame? I
don't
know. It's only been like 48 hours, so we'll see how the palace of shame goes, okay? I might just stick to J-Swipe where the nice Jewish boys are.
Jay's wife.
Jay's
I'm going to copyright
Jay's wipes.
all right, I'll read my best tweet then. From at Radio TFB on Twitter.
Okay.
I said, guys, cats have mouths. Hello Kitty can't eat and is therefore clearly some sort of demon. Always has been. And I stand by that.
I saw that one.
Hello Kitty's not a cat. Never has been a cat.
She's a kitty.
She's not. No, she's not.
Yeah, she is.
You didn't see this what that was going on this week? That where the creator of Hello Kitty said Hello Kitty's not a cat?
Oh my god, no.
Yeah, Hello Kitty's not a cat.
Oh.
Wow.
What is Hello Kitty?
What?
What is it?
Hello Kitty is supposed to be a girl. Like a human girl.
Wow. What?
But with cat ears and whiskers.
You're dropping a lot on us at the end of the podcast.
I realize that's
yeah, it's not enough of the moral high ground. I gotta drop bombs on us.
I realize that's a lot to deal with, but I'm just making the point that cats have mouths and you can't be a living thing if you have a mouth.
Mm.
So Hello Kitty is some sort of...
A girl is a living thing.
That's what I'm saying. Hello Kitty's got to be some sort of phantasmagoria of some sort.
Okay. That's true. Very realistic
something
of you, and I like realism.
To ponder.
Something to ponder. As we leave you guys, once again, this has been a real pleasure as we wrap up this episode of Accept the Mystery. Until next time, peace and love.
Peace and love.